Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their business and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Conor McCarthy is an airline industry veteran with over 43 years experience, a serial entrepreneur and has helped set up several airlines and aerospace companies worldwide. He was the founder of Plane Consult, an aviation consultancy company, which has, over the past 19 years, worked in many airlines, including EasyJet, Qantas, Alaska Airlines, Copa and Thai Air Asia. He has held roles in Aer Lingus Commuter, Ryanair, where he was responsible for the famous 25-minute turnaround, among other things, and is co-founder, shareholder and former director of AirAsia and its affiliates in Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines, Japan and India. In 2009, Conor established Dublin Aerospace, parent company to Dublin Aerospace and Exeter Aerospace. Dublin Aerospace is now one of the world's leading providers of aerospace MRO services. Dublin Aerospace developed a state-of-the-art landing gear facility in Ashbourne and started up Exeter Aerospace in the UK. Based primarily in Dublin, Ireland, Conor is also the founder and executive chairman of Emerald Airlines, Ireland's newest regional airline and the exclusive operator of the Aer Lingus regional network. Conor, you're very welcome to the podcast.
I had to cut it short. It was a much bigger CV, but I had to cut it short or else I'd still be talking 20 minutes into the thing. We'll kick it off and I ask you a nice easy one to start off with. When did you consider yourself an entrepreneur or a business person?
That's a good question. I suppose to quote one of my fellow colleagues on the EY Entrepreneur of the Year program, when Ernst & Young gave me a phone call and said that I was a finalist in their Entrepreneur of the Year awards. I think most entrepreneurs never consider it as a function or a title in itself. They're just getting on with a job.
But when you look at entrepreneurship, do you think it's an art, a science, a philosophy, a practice? What do you think it is that unites entrepreneurs?
I think it's an illness, frankly. It's an illness. It's an inability of people who should know better to give up, because I think it was General Patton is often credited with the phrase that no plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. I think most of us who've done business plans over the years realise that. An entrepreneur is someone who says, okay, so that's not going to work. Let's pivot. Let's go here. Let's adapt. Let's change. Let's try and go for this one. And they never lose sight of their ultimate end goal, but the way they get there is never the way they plan. And I think an entrepreneur is someone who just has that doggedness about them. And the lucky ones are the ones who have a team around them who can shape that effort and who believe in them and who will follow them up the hill.
And like when you look at it yourself and you've set up the various businesses, one of the key things about entrepreneurs often is you have to wear so many different hats and you might not be good at all of those hats. And an awful lot of entrepreneurs think they need to be great at all those hats to be successful, right? So, you know, in terms of your journey, you know, was it about knowing what your strengths were and then finding like-minded individuals who could fill in the skills gap for you?
In my case, I suppose, well, first of all, I was very fortunate. I had a very good background and really, really met some fantastic people. Like during my time, I was 18 years with Aer Lingus, and some of the people I worked with there were just, you know, fantastic allies, friends and business colleagues over the years. You know, some of the better known names would be like so Willie Walsh and Alan Joyce. Stephen Kavanagh. So, you know, Willie went on to run BA and then IAG, formed that group and basically was the architect of the IAG, International Airlines Group. And then Alan went on to run Qantas Group, probably the most successful airline CEO ever in Asia and Australasia, and in this turnaround of that group and leaving it in the condition it's in today. And Stephen ran Aer Lingus. So I was very fortunate to work with people like that and many others who might not be known publicly but are well known in the industry. And from that, you kind of get born into a business, and then you develop a love or a passion for that business. And after that, you're looking at opportunities within that space. Because I've often thought, you know, for example, airlines are probably the worst possible performing component of aviation in general. So if you look at them, they have the highest risks and they have the lowest returns. And you say, why would you go in there? And you go in there because you were born into it almost. You know, if I had a bit of sense, I'd probably have pivoted and got into the financial services industry much earlier. Because when you play...
There's no future in that.
Well, I often do. When you play with money, you make money. And the financial services business is like that. But you are where you are. And if you have a real passion for your business, whether that's potato farming or whether it's aviation or whether it's, you know, running retail stores, that becomes your thing, and you're constantly challenged to be the master of your art, and it does become a bit of an art. There's a lot of science in there, obviously, but overall, the mix becomes an art.
And you know, you mentioned that you think the being an entrepreneur is an illness, but to what degree, I suppose, can naivety help you? That, like, if you actually sat down and thought about the journey, you go, nobody would ever do it, right?
So yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, I suppose the most obvious one and the most recent one is Emerald Airlines. So, you know, a number of opportunities, a bit like the Swiss cheese, aligned. The planets got in line back in May 2020, of all times, in the middle of our lockdown and COVID, and that opportunity was becoming real, where Aer Lingus were going to put their regional franchise out for tender, and it wasn't due to be turned over until early 23. And so, you know, we were sat back. Our advisory business had basically come to a full stop in February 2020 with the lockdown. So I had some resources around that were spinning their tires. And at the same time, Aer Lingus said, you know, we're going to put this business up for tender. And we knew there were a few players in the industry who were well established who were going to go for that tender, because it's a good, mature route network. It's got good latent profitability, but you have to do the job right. The margins are not particularly exciting. And yet, you know, you kind of look at that and say, there's an opportunity. But I was just in 2020, just coming up to my 60th birthday. So, that was 22. And, you know, you're kind of saying, why would you be trying to start an airline at this stage in your career? I started out in 78. So, you know, this year I'm probably 46 years in the business. So you're saying, well, because I've done it for a number of other people. I've done it in Malaysia. I've done it in Mexico. I've done it in Australia for other people. So I might as well do one for myself before I hit the road. And but, you know, when you're in the thick of running the airline, in our first year, it was 2022, was when we went operational. It was the bounce back from COVID. You know, revenge travel was the term being used. The problem was, while everyone wanted to travel after COVID, not too many people wanted to go back to work. And the airports didn't have enough staff. The security queues were out the door, literally, and into the car parks. We couldn't get baggage handlers. An awful lot of the key roles that exist in airlines and airports were laid off during COVID. And those people, in many, many cases, were not going back to work. In some cases, people who were, you know, getting up at 3 a.m. to be on a 4:30 shift said, hang on a sec.
Life's better than this.
I've been working down in the local kind of superstore. I've been delivering for Amazon and whatever. And I'm kind of earning not an awful lot less. And I don't have to do those sort of shifts, and I don't have to devote, in some cases, maybe all my weekends or whatever. So, you know, the airline business and aviation in general, airports included, lost a lot of key players. And it took a while to get them back. And that was a difficult first year of operations, because we had huge demand. We had a lot of people who wanted to fly, and yet the business, the airline business, which is a very finely tuned machine, had gone out of tune But thankfully, it took little over a year to get that tuned up again. And, you know, you go to Dublin Airport today, you can get through in 15 minutes. It's not a difficult experience. It's quite a hassle-free experience in many cases. And similarly on our flights, we set up our own ground handling unit. That's working really well for us. So, but the pains of getting that to work were real. And I was thinking as I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, many morning in 22 to load bags because we just didn't have enough people. I didn't sign up for this one, but you had to lead from the front. Mm. You had to show that you were willing to put your shoulder to the wheel to make a difference. And optically, it also is quite important that people realise that there's no job you won't do to get flights away on time.
And from that, and this question comes up all the time then, when you look at the Emerald Airline, that, you know, the culture that was forged, the company culture that was forged in those really, really tough times, probably stand to it now more than any. And like it's almost in adversity, the best types of culture are formed in that. People were, you know, throwing bags up. So a young lad who started as a baggage handler turns around, he sees the CEO slinging the same bag up on.
Hopefully not the same bag, because it means I missed it. But yeah, you're right. It's very good. And it's something that we really kind of engender in the business. We're a small airline. We've got the most aggressive, largest airline in Europe as our competitor. So about 90% of our capacity out of Dublin competes against Ryanair.
Okay.
So we have to be different. We have to be more agile. And Ryanair are an agile airline. Even though they're a big airline, they're quite agile. But we compete very successfully with them because we have to be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we try to play that difference is we're small and we can know all our people. Mm-hmm. We can give them a sense of identity, a sense of belonging. And also, because we're so small, everyone has a critical role. No matter who is in our business, they're there because their job is critical. Mm-hmm. So whether that's the person who runs our baggage sort belt over in Terminal 2 to make sure all the bags get off the transatlantic flights and onto the right Emerald flights, or whether it's the person who looks after our flight crew iPads to make sure they're all up to date, the latest manuals are loaded and that they work consistently. It doesn't matter. They all play a critical role in our kind of ecosystem, and each one of them has a name and we love to use the name. So that's where we try and make the difference. And you're right, you know, what do they say? The strongest steel gets forged in the hottest furnaces. So that's what we're hoping for.
And just on that, the Emerald Aviation thing, and I suppose it's a different model than you would have run in Asia and things like that, in that you have the whole idea of the subsidies and the Irish routes and things like that. You know, the obvious kind of, how important are the subsidies? You'd say very important, right? But so I won't give you an easy layup like that. But the other thing that you know, when you look at the relative difference, because particularly any of the stuff that's run in Ireland, you know, you're going, you know, you have credible transport alternatives. So how important is it to be pitching it against that? And I suppose the broader question that we're seeing with all the airlines now is this whole, you know, environmental impact, and oh, people are flying too much. And you know what? You shouldn't be taking an Emerald airline if you could hop on the train down or whatever. You know, where do you stand on all on the validity of having a regional airline, I suppose, is the question.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I guess to start, I should say that only 2 flights a day we operate out of. Today we'll operate 128 flights.
Okay.
2 of those round trips, so 4 flights out of 128, will operate to one domestic point in Ireland. Okay. That's Donegal. Everything else really flies from Ireland to the UK. So we fly everywhere from Aberdeen in the north right down to Southampton. We fly for British Airways to Gatwick. We fly for Aer Lingus to everywhere else. Although we take the commercial risk on those flights. So the Donegal flight, just to give you an example and to try and encapsulate what your question, which is absolutely valid. Mm-hmm. There's only That's the only route in our network where we would get a government subsidy. And the rationale for that is it takes 4.5 hours to drive to Donegal. If you take that 4.5 hour drive, you take one of our flights, you get there in 40 minutes. About 25% of our customers from Donegal are actually flying to Dublin for critical care, mm-hmm. whether that's for cancer treatment or, you know, dialysis or some form of specialist treatment in the critical care centres. So we provide a very important link for those people. And if they had to drive that, it just wouldn't be credible. And in fact, what we do for those particular customers is we give them free changes on their seats and so on, because they may not be right on the morning of their appointment. Their blood count may be off or whatever. And so we allow them a change. We also, you know, give them a free bag, and we give them a discount on what is already a subsidised fare. So the government see fit to support those sort of routes where there is no direct rail motorway connection, because it just otherwise, you know, the country is, it gets disconnected, and people who live in Donegal feel disconnected and so on. Having said that, the network of domestic routes, there's only really two existing domestic air routes in Ireland now. One is to Kerry and one is to Donegal. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no connection to... These are points that when I was in Aer Lingus Commuter, we served. So we used to serve Donegal, Sligo, Knock, Galway, Shannon, Kerry, Cork, even Waterford. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's only two of those points are served. So the domestic air network has pretty much imploded. And it's been overtaken in the most part by the motorway system that's been put down at cost of multi-billions, and the high-speed rail. Well, it's not that high speed, but it's higher, faster than it used speed. To be. Yeah. So from that point of view, I think, you know, the market has shifted. And there's very low levels of subsidy overall in the Irish Air Network. I mean, when you think about it, there's currently only one public service route. And we don't rely on that to any great extent. Our main objective is to make a profit commercially flying on routes to the UK. Okay. On the sustainability question, we fly an aircraft which is known as the ATR-72. It's a turboprop aircraft. It's a modern turboprop. It's the only one in production today. And that aircraft has the lowest greenhouse gas emissions of any aircraft in production today. And that's before we take in the contrail effects of modern jet aircraft, which is another iteration of greenhouse gas controls that's going to come in the next 10 to 20 years. So if you take it just on fuel alone, one of our aircraft burns about 2.5 litres per seat for every 100 kilometres we travel. And you take your average family saloon car, that's burning about 7 litres per seat for every 100 kilometres. And some of them as high as 11. But 7 isn't a bad number. So if you just consider that the average car on the road has less than 2 people in it, flying to Donegal on an ATR-72 is actually much more efficient. Okay. And it also saves you all that time, which has a real impact in terms of carbon. Because when you drive to Donegal, you don't drive without stopping. Mm-hmm. When you stop, you consume carbon. When you drive on the roads, those roads took a lot of carbon to lay down. They're taking carbon every year to maintain. There's a lot of steel and concrete goes into them, which has a much higher carbon footprint. Admittedly, it's a single shot solution, but they do produce a huge amount of carbon when they make cement and when they make steel. So from our point of view, there are sustainable arguments for air travel. And while there are other air travel cases where you might say that's not sustainable, we believe we have a very sustainable case and one that connects communities. And at the end of the day, if people can't connect, you know, what are we here for? So we do need to be able to connect people. And sometimes I feel, despite the arguments, the Green Lobby can conveniently forget that it's very important for communities to belong. Yeah. And helping communities belong, part of the whole Irish economic success story is we have connected with the world in many ways, including air travel.
As I said to you, you've set up several businesses through the years. What do you learn from each one that you bring to the next one?
Obviously not enough.
Not to do it again.
I shouldn't have done this. it's really good. I guess I really enjoy working with people. Right. And every business runs on its people. From the team that sets it up, to the team that manages it, to the people who do the actual different tasks every day. And when you see it well coordinated, and you see, you know, a day when, you know, everything works, and, you know, whether that's in Dublin Airspace when we're producing an aircraft after a heavy overhaul and we're presenting it back to our customer, British Airways or Jet2 or Aer Lingus, and it looks like brand new. It could be a 25-year-old aircraft, and everything is working well on it, and it's presented in a perfect way. And we've done some really complex repairs that'll never have to be done again. And that customer's happy because it's been delivered to them on time. You know, that's real teamwork and satisfaction. And the other thing that gives me great satisfaction is seeing a lot of the young people we've brought into the industry from their leaving certificate or from their first college degree, and bringing them up and watching them grow into professionals, watching them learn how to work, how to collaborate, and to basically become experts in their field. I was bowled over last year when I was, you know, sometimes on a Friday evening before I finish up, I might go for a stroll down the hangars and see what's going on. And one of the young guys who we took on as an apprentice probably 6 years ago was in the cockpit doing pre-flight checks on one of our customers' aircraft. And, you know, he was working through a checklist. He now was much larger with a beard, of course. They all have beards now by the age of 19 or 20. But he was like the confidence and professionalism which he was approaching his work. And he was working at a level that I never got to work at, because even though I was an apprentice at 16 and I qualified as an aircraft electrician, you know, I kind of moved on then to study and did a degree, etc. So I never got to that level of practical kind of professional efficiency. And you could really take a lot of satisfaction out of watching how that person had grown into the aircraft engineer they'd become.
So on that basis then, you know, as you sit as CEO, do you prefer to hire talent or develop from within?
I prefer to develop from within.
Right.
Because it's stickier.
Yeah.
And we suffer in both businesses from an exodus of talent, because there's always somebody who's going to pay more than the regional airline. There's always an airline that's willing to pay more than the aircraft maintenance shop, because, you know, we work on a daytime shift basis. We don't work through weekends and night times. And as a result of that, there's always someone who's willing to pay somebody to do that. Mm-hmm. And there's always someone inside who's willing to take the additional money. Yeah. And you can understand that. So I prefer develop from within, because that person grows up in the business, understands it innately. They learn the culture of the business as well as the task they're expected to do. So it's much less, there's much less churn with that particular person. And they add to the team from day one. The challenge, I suppose, with that type of person is, you like the guy I just mentioned who was in the cockpit, you've got to stop seeing them as the young 19 or 18-year-old just finished their leaving cert, coming in raw and not knowing anything on day one other than having a great passion for learning. And you've got to be able to relook at people as they develop within the organisation, so that you don't let them run out of opportunities because you still see them as the less experienced person they were 5 years ago.
So in that kind of case, is it better to have, like, if you look at, you know, when you set up AirAsia and things like that, and you had the various different brands under it, that you had the ability to for somebody to jump to another brand so that they were kind of doing the next job up, but not in the same place that they were doing their first job?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's a great example of it gives them a fresh perspective. It also gives them a new entree to a different team, and they're seen differently. But it also gives them the kind of fillip that they see, that they need to say, hey, someone's backing me here. Someone notices that I'm doing my job. Because we've so many people, we've over 500 people in Emerald now, and we've over 500 people in the Dublin Airspace group. And I'm sure there's plenty of them who does anyone know how much effort I put in every day here? Or, does, you know, and it is noticed. The funny thing is, it's noticed when you make the least noise, because they say, hey, she's just a consistent performer. No matter what you throw at that girl, she's really good at producing a result that stands up in daylight. And but not everybody hears it. And people, you know, you can't say thank you often enough, frankly. And, you know, and it has to be genuine. But you also have to have an interest in people and know what they're at. So you want to engender that in your leadership team, so it cascades down, that everybody is aware of the importance of individuals.
Every cog in the machine.
Absolutely. Because if one cog in a watch decides to stop, the watch stops turning. You know, so it doesn't matter if it's the biggest cog or the little one, you know, it'll stop turning. So it's a gearbox, and everyone has a key role in it.
And I suppose it's much more towards the Dublin Aerospace side of the business, but I know you have some strong enough views on apprenticeships and the lack thereof, or the lack of facilities to get these things going, you know?
Yeah, I do. I came through the apprenticeship myself, and that was, as I say, 46 years ago I started on that journey, and it was wonderful, and we got great training. It was an Aer Lingus apprenticeship, and you really felt you'd got the Willy Wonka golden ticket when you got an apprenticeship in Aer Lingus back in those days. Things have moved on hugely. Ireland has moved on hugely. There's a lot more opportunities for people. There's a huge degree of choice in third level, and you know, a lot of mammies and daddies like their kids to go and get the cap and gown at the end of a few years, and kids themselves like the university and the college experience. So, excuse me. So that's all important. Where I feel that we as a country have slipped up, and I was delighted that Simon Harris, when he was Minister for Higher Education, put this as one of his primary planks, that he was going to make sure traineeships and apprenticeships got the injection of effort and money and investment that they needed to bring them up and make them attractive. Because it's important to sell them. Where I feel a bit frustrated is we're still trying to train apprentices like we did 40 years ago. And if you talk to people in the institutions, we used to have a crowd called ANCO, and ANCO then became SULAS, and then after some crisis, SULAS suddenly became FOSS. So we've got all, or it was FOSS, and then FOSS became SULAS. We've got these organisations that they've changed their brand plenty of times, but they haven't rewired. So the way we train aircraft apprentices, for example, is still pretty antique, you know, it's retrograde. So we're looking at different ways of training. We're in a you know, a loose industry group. It's informal, but it's well connected with some of the major players in Ireland. So Dublin Aerospace, Atlantic Aviation in Shannon, Ryanair, Aer Lingus Emerald. We're trying to get the people who are responsible for training. And we have like 1.5 billion euros in the national training budget, which is not yet spent. So there's huge money there. So money shouldn't be the issue. But what we're just simply saying is there's a different way of doing this, which will give the students much better education. It will give the sponsoring companies a much more practical approach, where the individuals are brought forward much more efficiently, and where the manner in which we examine, because in aviation, as you can imagine, the standards are very high. So you're looking at a 75% pass mark. Now, my kids went through college and got master's degrees and honours degrees. You know, you get a first class honour above 70%. If you get 70% in an aviation exam, you fail. You know, so the way we train for these exams and the way we examine people needs to be changed. So it's done on a proper modular basis, and your comprehension is tested. It's not an exam, it's a comprehension. Do you understand what you're looking at here? Do you understand where you would find this information? Instead of relying on your memory, you must go to the manual. And stuff like that, I feel, is it's just, it's not been thought out straight enough. And there's a lot of dogged this is how we always
we
do
always
it.
Did it, yeah. And I did it, and he did it before me.
Yeah,
and
my father's father. So there's a bit of the old craft union thing comes through there, I think, where it's changed. And the engineering is better now than it was. The individuals are better than I was. I don't think I'd get through a modern apprenticeship as quickly. But having said that, you know, it's a question of training appropriately. And we can learn a lot. The US FDI into Ireland the last 30 years, you know, whether it's in IT or pharma or, you know, hardware like, you know, Intel and Apple, they brought with them an approach to training people, which is very pragmatic. And we can adapt that here. And we could have adapted it a lot earlier.
Yeah.
So it's a drum I've been beating for a long time now, but I won't stop. It has to happen.
I know Emerald is in its infancy, and if you will, but and you know, Dublin Airspace isn't necessarily that much older than it. But how do you feel about what you've already done in both companies?
I'm very proud of both, actually. Right. I'm very proud of the team in both. I'm very get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing the particularly with Dublin Airspace. You have to remember it was started in 2009, and if you cast your mind back then, Ireland was a very, very broken place. I was doing work in Australia early that year when I heard the news that SR Technics were closing down all their Irish operation, and it came as a real body blow because this facility had been on the site in Dublin Airport for 75 years. And, you know, I remember going in there and we counted up all the different skill sets and trades and, you know, what we needed. There were 18 different skill sets at work. Everything from non-destructive testing technicians through to sheet metal workers, structures engineers, avionics engineers, all the way. There was a huge amount of different tasks that were done. And it was really just a whole pool of expertise. So to think that could be just switched off and closed really gave me the jitters, I have to say, because I was doing fine. The business was internationalized. I had no Irish clients. This was plain consult or advisory business. And, you know, we were, you know, trading nicely, even though there was a global financial crisis and even though Ireland was particularly badly hit. But I just recall at the time thinking, these are almost indigenous industries. Ireland started in aviation the same time as the rest of the world, and it has proven itself to be a leader in so many areas of aviation that if facilities like the one in Dublin were to be closed and mothballed, they'd never restart, and we'd lose that, and we'd lose the ability to basically produce great aircraft engineers, which in themselves have become a lifeblood to the leasing industry, which itself has become a lifeblood to the financial services and legal industry in Dublin. So, you know, there's an ecosystem there. So was really, you know, delighted to be able to get back and put that business on a profitable footing. We're 15 years in business. We lost money in year one, as most businesses do. We broke even in year two, and we've made profit ever since. Even during COVID, we made a small profit. But the proud thing about COVID is we kept everybody at work, and we even boosted our training numbers, and we boosted our apprentice numbers during COVID, where we took advantage of open opportunities that were there in these courses. So, you know, very proud of establishing, our credentials as a really competitive aviation business there.
And what was I thinking about the move from the airport to Ashburn?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, the rates in Dublin Airport are absolutely shocking, right?
Yeah, but it's not like you're moving a small thing.
No, it's not. It's a big ship to move. Basically, we haven't moved the aircraft maintenance from Dublin. Okay. That has to remain in Dublin Airport because aircraft generally need a runway to survive a landing, you know? So we need a hangar at the end of a runway somewhere, and Dublin Airport's our home. With the landing gear business, we were particularly successful in landing gear. We've, you know, three main business activities in Dublin Aerospace, and one of them is landing gear. And we decided we needed to move from the constrained facility we were in. The DAA also wanted that particular hangar back, and they wanted to convert that as part of their expansion. So we bought a site in Ashburn. It was just on the right side of the toll bridges coming out of Dublin. It was just on the right side of Ashburn, where housing was much more affordable. And it also was in a pool of population where we felt we could absolutely attract people from as far north as Dundalk, out as far as even Mullingar, to come and work there. And so we built a facility, which is the one of the most modern in the world now, to overhaul landing gears. So it consists of very extensive and expensive machine tools, very extensive plating shops, large non-destructive testing facilities, and obviously an assembly hall where we put it all back together again. We've a great team out there. We've over 110 people there now. We have capacity to double the number of landing gears we can produce. And the amazing thing for most people is we are competitive globally with that business. So we have airlines in the United States who put their landing gear in crates and send them to us, and they get them overhauled and sent back at a competitive price and time frame to our competitors in Mexico. Oh. We also have customers in Southeast Asia who will ship landing gears all the way to Dublin, and we can turn them around and get them back to Southeast Asia at a competitive price to the local Chinese and Singaporean and Thai producers. So we do that because we've a really flexible, highly skilled workforce. Mm-hmm. So while some of these other economies pay a lot less because their cost of living is a lot less, etc., we find that the skill sets we have are grounded in really high quality, low error production, and also people who can adapt very quickly. So it's not unusual for me to go out to Ashburn and see somebody who's been working on our 1 million euro grinding machine 1 week to be in the inspection shop the next week inspecting at a microscopic level some of the metal components we take off the landing gear to ensure they aren't cracked. So we have that adaptable skill set. Basically a great bunch of people who work together to meet customer demand. And we've got some really big customers. We're proud to say we have Aer Lingus as a customer. We have Ryanair as a customer, AirAsia, Allegiant Airlines in the United States, one of the lowest cost airlines in the United States, finds it economically attractive to send their gears all the way to Dublin to get them overhauled. And you know, so we're quite proud of our competitiveness in that business. And I'm very passionate about Irish industry remaining competitive, because I think it's one of the biggest dangers we face with prosperity is you can lose sight of competitiveness. And while everybody's happy, if your competitiveness gets eroded, it's a real danger for everybody. And you know,
it's a one-way street.
Yeah, it's very hard to recover it if you've lost it. And for us, it's really important. And, you know, we work on it all the time. And we've got, it's such a great bunch of people who, they don't need reminding, actually, to be fair, because most of those people started with us having lost their only career and their only job, which was in SR mm-hmm. Technics. So, you know, it's interesting how that corporate memory is very important. Mm-hmm. And we don't run on fear, by the way. You know, it's mm-hmm. they're very positive, and they have a really good, positive, adaptable outlook, because if you haven't got confidence, change becomes difficult to manage. Yeah. But we're very focused on remaining competitive, because, you know, we grew up in the 70s and 80s when unemployment was the greatest scourge in the country. And I never want to go back there. We want to make sure people all have really valid competitive jobs to do.
And if you wanted to double that business over the next 5 years, could you get the people to do it? Going back to our apprenticeship thing, yeah, things like that,
yeah,
you know?
It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. We've had a challenge. Last year, we found it really problematic to hire skilled fitter turners and tool makers. We have a tool maker apprenticeship, small numbers, and, you know, they get snapped up fairly quickly. But we have started to also bring people in who have those skills. So we've found other avenues to hire, but we're constantly hiring and training ourselves. But no, I remain positive on our ability to attract people. And, you know, Ireland and actually, in fairness, the Irish government have worked hard to ensure that key skills can be brought into the country.
Right.
So I'm a big fan of being able to do that and being able to offer people a really good standard of living here who can come in with those skills. But we're constantly in hiring mode, which is great. Yeah. I mean, it's a first class problem and it's great for the country. We just need to keep our head about us and make sure that we don't feel that the customer will absorb any price increase, because they won't. I mean, you know, we've got...
They're running competitive businesses, yeah, competitive industries as well.
You know? Well, you know, just take, our biggest customer in Ashburn's probably is Ryanair, who happens to be my biggest competitor in Emerald, right? But Ryanair run on, you know, their mantra is low cost. That's what they try to do, and they don't they're very efficient, they're very focused on quality, but they need price, they need the right price for so, you know, it's no sense in me going to them and say, yeah, well, we're going to give the lads a 10% increase this year, is that all right with you? You know, like, They have to find the right cost base as well. So, we're not, you know, we're very alive to that. And but thankfully, all our people are, and they don't waste money. You know, they look at stuff and they say, is there a better way of doing this? And everyone is free to contribute their ideas. And hopefully, we've created an environment where those ideas percolate very quickly as well. That's key.
On that idea then, and in terms of the business that you've set up, how important is it that your capital investors are aligned with you and your goals when you're starting those businesses up?
That's hugely important.
Right.
Hugely important. I mean, both of these businesses are big absorbers of capital. I mean, you know, as I say, airlines probably have big barriers to entry in terms of capital, the highest risks and the lowest returns. So you have to find some fellow insane capital investors to get into the airline.
And there's a few of them around.
Thankfully I found a few. But it's a hugely satisfying business when it works. The problem is it never stays still. So it's like sailing a boat in a storm. You know, if you're on a good tack, that's great, but you're going to have to turn at some point, and everything is going to have to change then. So look, it's a key one for us. Bringing our shareholders along with us on the journey is important. Thankfully, you know, the Emerald story has gone well. Same with Dublin Aerospace. So our initial investors in Dublin Aerospace, we bought most of them out in 2017, so they got about 2.5 times their money. So it wasn't bad after, 7 years of invested money. And so, you know, Dublin Aerospace is quite tightly held now and probably the largest shareholder with about 80%. So, you know, that's helpful. We've never taken a dividend, something we should be doing, should have done maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but COVID impacted on our ability to do that. Having said that, you know, it's about keeping the business healthy. So we invested in the facility in Ashburn. That was about $15 million worth. And we've also invested in Exeter, where we took over the old Flybe maintenance hangars in Exeter to overhaul regional aircraft. And we've a team of about 120 there now. So we've got 7 hangar bays there, and we're building up, and we've started an apprenticeship there and so on. We've basically replicated the Dublin Aerospace model. So while we may not have, the capital may not have come back out to the main investors at this stage.
Myself. Growing every time.
Yeah, it's you're putting it to good use. And, you know, it's a good use of capital. It's not just a question of taking money off the table. What are you going to do with it? Yeah. You know, and I think it's important that you have patient capital. I think that's probably the best term to describe patient capital. Yeah.
Particularly in the cyclical industry, you need patient capital.
Yeah, I think so. And you need patient lenders as well, you know. And I think we've been fortunate in both fronts.
Do you obsess about the small things?
I think I don't. Other people think I do. Yeah. I know our Gatwick flight was 40 minutes late this morning. It was the only one that was late. And I'm
Drives you mad, doesn't it?
Well, I'm just wondering why ATC gave us a delay when other airlines got in and out of London airspace on time. And I'm wondering, is there something we could have done differently? you know, to eliminate that issue, because it may be ATC, but at the end of the day, the customers were 40 minutes late. Having said that, we did land within 10 minutes of our landing time, which is how ATC works a lot. And as you know, we have to pad out our block time sometime, particularly in busy airports like Dublin, where the taxi time can be as long as 35 minutes and it can be as short as 6 minutes. So, you know, sometimes with ATC, they sometimes they do know what they're doing, but it can be frustrating to see a departure that's a little bit late when everything else went on time.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
I guess I love winning. Losing, you have to figure out why you lost and try and learn from it and give yourself a bit of a, you give yourself a beating up if you've lost for the same reason twice. You know, that's annoying, but you'll always lose for some reason. It's just going, how do I avoid that next time?
And in that regard, then, has fear of failure been a big driving force for you?
No. I probably think that's one of the reasons that we're all insane as entrepreneurs. Failure doesn't come into it. I mean, it really doesn't. You know, you have to have momentum. You just don't stop. You have to have momentum and find a way.
And, you know, when you look back then and over the various different guises, and as I said, it's not as if you're not still at the teeth of it, but what percentage of your success would you say is down to luck and what's hard work?
I'd say a huge amount of it is down to luck. It's down to the opportunity arising at a particular time. Now, I was in a class of apprentices with 12 other, well, there were 12 of us, 11 other guys, and I definitely wasn't the smartest in that class. And I definitely wasn't the most mechanically gifted in that class. And I definitely wasn't the sharpest at certain things. So you wonder, okay, so, you know, and by the way, I'm not necessarily the successful one in that, but I'm just in terms of, there were other people in that group who really you'd admire for their smarts, smarts or for their ability to think things through. They just may not have taken opportunities that came their way because they wanted to stay in a particular mode. That their life at the time left them in a position where they said, no, I'm going to stay at this. I'm going to keep going. Whereas I had my head up and was looking around for opportunities to break away from the pack. I definitely got that sense about myself early enough that, you know, when I was an apprentice, I did some night classes. I broke my leg in a football match. I was out on crutches for 4 weeks before these City and Guilds exams, which we weren't due to sit for the until the following year. I had nothing better to do than do some past papers. I ended up going in and getting those exams a year early. And my colleagues said, oh, don't stop now. I said, well, what can I do now? That's the full technical certificate. They said, you can go and do a degree at night. And then, so one thing led to another. But I did take the opportunities as they came. And a bit like the Emerald story, that was an opportunity I wasn't looking for. But when it came, I said, you know, there might never be a better time to have a absolute greenfield airline starting here in Ireland to pick up what is the oldest part of Aer Lingus's network, like routes like Bristol and Liverpool and places like that, that Aer Lingus started flying to because the planes wouldn't go any further.
What's the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
That's an interesting one. Balance, I think.
Is it?
Getting a balance in all things, time for your family, time for your friends, time for your business, time for the people in the business, and knowing that at the end of the day, you'll never get everything done that you would like to have got done, but feeling that you've distributed your effort fairly evenly, if not across the day, across the week. That's I think that's the hardest one, striking the balance, getting not letting anything take over.
Now, we're coming to the final question.
Oh, the black book.
The black book is out. Here we go. Keep your fingers crossed, because I keep my fingers crossed.
I wonder who your last guest was.
Right. Now, I've absolutely lucked out on this one, right? Where in the world gave you the most satisfaction from a business sense?
And where would you like to go to next?
That's an interesting question. So I've been very fortunate. I've worked in, like, I grew up in the same part of Dublin as my grandfather and my wife's grandfather, and she did the same. So, and our kids are there, and two of our kids have houses in the same area. So, you know, I never particularly thought I'd be a globetrotter of any sort, and quite love living where I do in Drumcondra today. And yet then I got the opportunity, you know, after leaving Ryanair, to go and work in Malaysia and Kuala Lumpur, and then in Bangkok, and then worked in Mexico City and Monterrey with Viva Aerobus, and then Sydney and Melbourne with Qantas, and various other places. So you would think I'd have developed a real love for these other places, and I have. But I have to bring it back to Dublin.
Yeah.
Because this is a tough country to do well in, right? You know,
tough audience.
Yeah, you know that restaurant in Dame Street that used to be there, Frère Jacques, yeah. And he had a lobster tank in the middle of it, and someone said to him once, apparently, this is the story, as the story goes, "Hey, Jack, how come the lobsters don't escape?" And he said, "Oh, it's very easy. These are Dublin lobsters. The minute one climbs to the top, the rest drag him back in again." And so
I never heard that.
Yeah. So I think you know, I mean, it's very important in Ireland not to get notions, yeah, not to think you're you know, better than someone else, or you deserve more, and that's important, and it's good lesson in humility. So I think achieving it in your backyard is probably more satisfying, because it's probably the hardest place to excel. We do very well abroad in Ireland, I have to say. Everywhere I go in the world, I meet Irish people who have done so well and are such wonderful flag carriers for the country. And they leave a nice path for the people coming behind them. And thankfully, we've never been a colonial power. So there's no one hates us from the start, you know. So, yeah, I think Dublin would have to be that place. Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Conor McCarthy. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.